Chapter 29. Large number of Indian tribes. Among these were the Wallapais and the Havasupais. Garces' Diary. Dr. Elliot Cowes, who visited the Havasupais in 1881 with a governmental party, has translated Garces' Diary, and it was published a short time ago by Francis P. Harper, of New York. In this translation, he describes the descent of his, Cowes, party into the canyon, and his description is so vivid that it is well worth repetition here. Dr. Cowes' description of trail to Havasu Canyon. Oh, on the 10th, a march of 10 miles in the same direction brought us abruptly to the brink of the precipice, a sharp-edged jump off of perhaps 1,000 feet. There was no side canyon here for gradual descent. The firm level ground gave no hint of the break before us until we were actually upon the verge, and when the soldiers lined up to look down, an involuntary murmur of astonishment ran through the ranks. Dismounting and going in single file, each man leading his horse, we took the dizzy trail, a narrow footpath, in many parts of which a misstep would have been destruction to man or beast. The way zigzagged at first for some distance, on the switchback principle by which railroads sometimes make grades otherwise impracticable. The face of the precipice was so steep that, as we filed along, those of us at the head of the procession looked up to see the other sections of the train almost overhead. Certainly a fall of any man there would have been right on top of us. Then the trail took a long lurch to the left with little descent, hugging the face of the cliff, and we looked like a row of ants on a wall. This brought us at length to the head of a great talus, down which the trail zigzagged. The incline was too steep for straight descent, probably at an angle of 45 degrees. This fetched us into the bed of Cataract Canyon, perfectly dry. The trail was nearly a mile long, and it took us an hour to make our creepy way down. The Havasupai chief, who had been advised of our coming, was there to meet us with some of his men, all mounted, and he took us up the canyon about 5 miles to a place where there was a scanty aggage, not sufficing for the wants of the whole party. Next morning we retraced our steps down the canyon, and kept on in its bed until we reached the wonderful blue spring above described, and the wonderful rancheria of the Indians, a distance from last night's camp of about 25 miles, as we had struck the canyon some 20 miles above the living water. Other trails to the canyon. Garces came into the canyon by another trail, entirely distinct from this, commonly known as the Wallapai Trail. He left Havasu Canyon by still another trail, known as the Makai Trail, which leads directly from this canyon to the home of the Apis. In 1857, Lieutenant Joseph C. Ives made the descent into Havasu Canyon down the Wallapai Trail. His account of the journey reads like a novel, and people who are unfamiliar with the wonderful engineering feats of the Havasu Indians can scarcely believe that Ives did not allow his imagination to run away with him in his descriptions of the Havasupais' trails. Later, Lieutenant Cushing, guided by his Indian friends, rode across country to the Apis, and then secured a Hopi guide who took him to see the Havasupais over the Makai Trail. He confirms all that Ives and Cowes have written of the astonishing character of these trails. Having been up and down these trails many times during the last dozen years, I can say without hesitation that there are no more startling trails to be found in our Southwest. Trip from Eltover. One of the most enjoyable of the more arduous trips taken by visitors to Eltover is this trip to Havasu Cataract Canyon. Only those who enjoy a strenuous outing should arrange for this trip, and then plenty of time should be allowed to do it without too great rushing. The first portion, to the head of the Topocabia Trail, is generally done in a buckboard. The distance is 35 to 40 miles, over a varying road, good in places, fair in others, and wretchedly poor now and again. Arrived at the hill top, as the Indians call this point, the conveyance must be abandoned, and all the outfit for sleeping, Cooking and eating is transferred to the backs of pack animals, which have been sent on ahead. The visitors take saddle animals. There are those who make this drive, and then ride to the village, 15 miles further down the trail, in one day. A better plan is either to make dry camp at the head of the Tobacabia Trail, or, if time permits, descend to the Tobacabia Spring, which flows out of the base of the immense cliff down which one fork of the trail descends. For there are now two ways of descending the Tobacabia, to the right or the left of a mountain which overlooks the canyon. The trail by which I first entered Havasu Canyon is the one to the left, looking into the canyon. Tobacabia Spring. Arrived at the spring, the stock can be watered, packs removed, beds unrolled, and camp made for the night. The water, however, is not of the best for drinking purposes, though the Indians habitually use it. Pictographs. The following morning an early start may be made, and the winding course of Tobacabia Canyon followed to its entrance into the main Havasu Canyon. Here a number of interesting pictographs may be seen on the wall to the left, reminding one somewhat of those found in Mallory Grotto at El Tovar. Havasupai Gardens. Except in the rainy season, the upper portions of the main Havasu Canyon and all its tributaries are dry and sandy. Just before one reaches the village, however, the barrenness disappears. 1,000 springs appear, and unite to form a stream which, in less than 100 yards, will measure from 4 to 6 feet deep and fully 8 feet across. It is this stream that renders life possible for the Indians. For the distance of about 2 miles, the bed of the canyon, which is here filled with sandy earth, is irrigated from this rapidly flowing stream. The result is that with comparatively little labor the Havasupais are able to produce excellent crops of corn, beans, chilies, onions, melons, squash and other vegetables. After the advent of the Spaniards, they obtained peach trees, and they now grow far more peaches than they can eat, drying large quantities, some of which they sell to ranchers, miners and other outsiders. They also have fine figs. Since this chapter was put into type, the Havasupai village has been swept nearly out of existence by a flood. The winter of Agagigto saw a large fall of snow on the plateau, which, melting suddenly during a hot spell in January, rushed down the canyon in a body, destroyed the school, agent's house, and took away nearly all the havas, fields, and orchards of the Indians. This catastrophe has several times occurred to them according to their traditions, so there is little doubt but that they will ere long replant their cornfields and re-establish their homes in the spot they love so well. The Havasupai Awa. The house of a Havasupai is called a awa. It is a primitive structure, generally built of cottonwood poles, willows, and earth. Occasionally one of the leading men will put up a more pretentious home, whose sides will be of matted willows, plastered inside and out with mud, and with a mud-covered row, of which will turn the rain. A basket maker's paradise. There are about 30 basket makers among the Havasupais, and specimens of their work may be found in the Hopi house. As Havasu Creek is lined with willows that are admirably adapted for basket making, and as an abundant supply of martinia, or cat's claw, is found on the plateaus above, this canyon is a veritable basket maker's paradise. Their best work is done in the coiled stitch. The asuas, or water bottles, are made out of the twined weave, and then covered with pinyon gum. Beautiful waterfalls. Havasu Canyon is interesting, not only on account of its Indians, but because of its narrow walls reaching up to the very heavens and shutting out the sun except for the midday hours, and the beautiful blue water flowing in its willow-fringed bed, which finally dashes in successive leaps into the lower depths, making several cataracts, one of which I regard as the most exquisite waterfall in the world. As a consequence, it is becoming a great attraction for travelers. Bridal Veil Falls. There are 5 falls in all, occurring in the following order. Havasupai, Navajo, Bridal Veil, Mooney, and Beaver. The last 3 are the most important. Bridal Veil is about 170 feet high and 500 feet broad, but this space is not entirely covered with water. The edge is so broken that the water dashes over the precipice in a large number of stream and falling upon several different ledges, is again broken into a dashing spray, which, light and feathery, again leaps into the air. The general effect is indescribably beautiful. The visitor should not fail to cross the creek either above or below the Bridal Veil Falls, for on the further side are a number of water concretions well worth seeing. Mooney Falls. Mooney Falls, 1 mile farther down, is a much higher cataract, but the water falls in an undivided stream. It gets its name from an unfortunate miner who, in trying to descend a rope ladder to the bottom of the falls, fell and was dashed to pieces. Beaver Falls. Beaver Falls are about 4 miles farther down the canyon and receive their name from the large number of beavers that used to be at work in the stream close by. By recent survey of this region, it has been found that these falls are not included in the Havasupai Reservation. It is to be hoped, however, that, before it is too late, this canyon, its waterfalls and surroundings, will be made into a national park, forever and inalienably to belong to the people. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.